Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. You know, this episode, it's a little bit interesting because we're going to pick up where we left off on the last episode. We talked about Shopko's liquidation to close out the last show, and no, we're not going to talk about them again this week, but we moved from a failed small to mid-sized market retailer to three, really, that are attempting to bounce back from recent struggles. So we're going to cover three different retailers that typically take hold in small to mid-sized markets, so they do have larger market holdings throughout their portfolio. A reminder to like us and rate us wherever you access us, and also check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we begin the show with positivity as Hibbett Sports releases earnings that beat even our own wildest expectations for earnings per share. The earnings call came along with the CEO succession announcement that put a bit of a damper on the good times, but it's important to rewind to around 2 years ago when same-store sales metrics were poor and there wasn't a clear path back to prior sales levels. In fact, same-store sales were down 11% in the second quarter of their last fiscal year. In late, many analysts suggested that it was a matter of smaller market customers turning to e-commerce for their sporting goods, but we saw it a bit differently.
Yeah, we did. We actually thought it was a matter of discretionary income being a bit more slight for smaller to mid-sized markets. In a video that we posted to YouTube, we made the case that it was a number of retailers who sold in these markets that were struggling, and not just Hibbett Sports. And it was really an issue more endemic to the markets themselves rather than the retailers. This hypothesis appears to be somewhat correct as economic conditions have improved in these markets here lately. A number of these same struggling retailers have bounced back. Hibbett perhaps having the most success of the group, but Kato, as we'll mention later, and Ascena Retail Group have also managed to stabilize their current business conditions. Dollar General, whose earnings we discussed last week and their beat despite a little bit of soft guidance there, has performed well overall as of late. Bath & Body Works, who have really had an impressive number of small and mid-sized market stores throughout the country, have just been crushing it as of late. We delve into the earnings now, and the earnings numbers were made a bit difficult to compare year over year because of two main factors. First, 2019's fourth quarter included 13 weeks. Last year, 14 weeks. So adjustments needed to be made for that. Second, as listeners or retail enthusiasts overall may recall, Hibbett Sports made a move to acquire City Gear in October of the last year, and with the deal closing in December. So with this first quarter, you have a number of changes we have to include, in which City Gear's revenue showed up on Hibbett's balance sheet, among other charges. The acquisition of City Gear, by the way, played heavily in the variance of other numbers, which we'll see in a bit as we dig a little bit deeper. Overall revenue for the company increased double digits thanks to those acquisitions, 14.7% to $306 million, up from around $266.7 million in the prior year's fourth quarter. If you adjust to take out the sales of City Gear and the extra week in the fiscal 2018's fourth quarter, you get a sales increase year over year of approximately $3.7 million. And this was not a figure they openly gave, but simple mathematics gets you to arrive at that figure. So with all of the factors at play, revenue was positively impacted by same-store sales and the acquisition of City Gear, negatively impacted by some store closures, some of those underperforming stores for them, and the lack of an extra week this year. Also providing impact to the top-line revenue boost were digital sales, which were up 60% year-over-year and comprised of 10.6% of total sales overall. That's a pretty good fraction of the pie because this is a retailer in Hibbett Sports that you don't often think is an online retailer, but they certainly are being a bit more impactful for their customer base. They said they were in, and I quote, good traction with buy online, pick up in store, which was also credited for helping to boost some same store sales.
And speaking of those same store sales, they were the star of the show as far as we were concerned. Same-store sales for Hibbett stores increased 3.8% on a 13-week to 13-week basis over last year's fourth quarter, far outpacing inflation. And by 13-week to 13-week, I mean we're adjusting here for that extra week last year. Now, this number compared favorably to others in the space, including Dick's, whose sales numbers decreased 2.2% on comps. And a quick note here, when we're kind of comparing retailers in the sporting goods space, Hibbett aligns more closely with Dick's in that they carry far more equipment and goods than apparel. The two are more similar, for example, than I would say the likes of Foot Locker and the newly private Finish Line. Part of the reason we haven't talked about Finish Line of late is because, of course, kind of bought out or merged, and as such, no earnings calls of late for that company. Foot Locker, by the way, their same store sales were impressive in their latest quarter. But moving on and keeping on Hibbett here, according to CEO Jeff Rosenthal, the increases were driven by what else? Product assortment. And also, he mentioned the closures of unproductive stores. By weeding out those unproductive stores, basically kept the higher performing stores in the portfolio, making those same store sales numbers better. Now, sometimes we're critical of store closures as far as their ability to increase same store sales metrics. And this is overall usually because chains will claim to close underperforming stores, but really they're closing stores as leases end, regardless of performance, just as an easy way to get out of those leases. In this case, there appears to be a real benefit to their current store evaluation program, more of which we'll talk about later on. Now, the part that impressed analysts was the earnings per share for the quarter. There were, of course, adjustments for one-time expenses related to the purchase of City Gear. In fact, unadjusted, net income was just $6.6 million this year versus $9.7 million last year. But adjusting for non-recurring costs related to the acquisition, their net income hit $10.5 million for the quarter, and that's even without the extra week in this year's quarter. This parlayed itself into non-GAAP earnings per share of 57 cents in this quarter versus 51 cents last year, and this was a substantial beat over Zacks' consensus estimates of just 38 cents per share on a percentage basis. In fact, a whopping 55% beat. Now, all of this and their continued strong outlook for fiscal 2020 led to their stock popping a whopping 20.3% on the date of the earnings call, Friday, March 21st. This as all three main indices, you'll recall, for that day were down more than 1.7%. So they were able to go up significantly in a day where the market was taking a general beating. Let's look forward to some initiatives they have for fiscal year 2020. I mentioned we'd talk more about their store reevaluations, and they were very clear that those initiatives will continue. Now, whether this is a good thing or not depends on how you evaluate the company's long-term goals. Their strategic realignment, as they call it, expects to see Hibbett shed around 95 Hibbett stores and add 10 to 15 Hibbett and City Gear stores. They specified also that currently no City Gear stores are tabbed for closure in fiscal year 2020, and that's kind of unusual. Usually the first thing you see when a chain gets bought out, even a successful chain gets bought out, is you see some store closures because of redundancies. Here, though, they're choosing to close the Hibbett stores over the City Gear stores. And for us, overall, the closures tabbed for this next year, that seems a bit much. Reason being, management continued to trumpet their omni-channel successes throughout the chain. And as we've said before, the only way to have true omni-channel efforts is to actually maintain brick and mortar outlets as well. And if buy online, pick up in store is truly taking off for them, it seems to make very little sense to trim a net of 7% of their store base, especially since their model means that seldom are two Hibbett stores located in the same market, meaning if you close down in one market, it's quite a drive for someone to take advantage of those buy online, pick up in store options, usually at least 20, 30 miles or more. In essence, though, it seems like they feel like these stores are dragging the chain down enough to forfeit any omni-channel sales in these markets and likely a big chunk of their digital sales in those same markets. We know from macro data, but also data from other companies that are out there, that digital sales are often strongest in markets where stores have a physical presence. Now, during fiscal 2019, they did close a net of 52 stores. That's independent of any City Gear stores closed. So the store closures will actually increase in 2020 if the company's own projections are correct. And although this latest quarter showed that, you know, closing some stores and paring down some stores can make you a bit more profitable, certainly we're kind of scratching our heads wondering if closing a net nearly 80 stores might be damaging to the chain long term as they lose footholds in those markets. Currently, the chain has holdings of 1,163 stores, 136 of which are City Gear locations.
And when you look at the projected numbers for fiscal year 2020, it's worthwhile to wonder if the company is sandbagging somewhat or if they're truly concerned about their ability to sustain their turnaround with the Hibbett brand. They're expecting negative 1% to positive 1% same-store sales increases for the next fiscal year, despite the fact that for this fiscal year, 2019, same-store sales were up 2.2%. So left us sort of scratching our heads thinking that, do they really foresee same-store sales coming in below projected inflation metrics? We'll wait to see. But you have to look at the fact, too, that they've trimmed their store base and the inclusion of City Gear in same-store sales figures beginning in the fourth quarter fiscal year 2020. It should be interesting to see where exactly they line up versus in-house projections. Additionally, they see a decline in their gross margin rate between 35 and 55 basis points, not including non-recurring expenses. You think of those one-time expenses, maybe part of the City Gear acquisition, and flat selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percentage of store sales. They do project solid non-GAAP earnings per diluted share between $1.80 and $2 per share, which is another likely reason the stock saw the increase that it did on Friday, because regardless of their strategy, investors always want to see those earnings per share projections and like to see favorable numbers, unlike the ones we saw with Dollar General last week. Shares ended the trading week around $21.70, up 50% since trading in December. They currently have a market cap of around $396 million. And with that, we move on to our second story. It's on to Cato now, whose stores share a lot of real estate with Hibbett, as they report on their Seesaw fourth quarter Thursday and provide an outlook for the next fiscal year. Interestingly enough, Trent, during a larger market sell-off on Friday, Cato shares were actually up a tiny bit, 0.43% after the Thursday call. Cato's prior three quarters, by the way, had been enough of a success that even a mediocre quarter would cap off the year on a decent note. And a mediocre quarter is exactly what they got, is with the last show's coverage of Neiman Marcus. As you may remember, how you view this earnings call depends on how you view the health of the company overall, as there were positives and negatives in equal measure. A little bit about Cato before we dig in to the most recent report. Since we don't discuss Cato a lot on the podcast and our listeners in larger markets may not be familiar with the retailer, we wanted to share a quick background on the company. As with Ascena Retail Group, who is very similar in terms of makeup, Cato has four different store banners, the main one being Cato, which has female fashions and mostly private label apparel and geared towards a wide range of consumers. Most Cato stores are in small to mid-sized markets. They also have Versana, which operates in very, very differentiated segments. Versana stores are typically located in larger metropolitan areas in A-class or power shopping centers, as some would call them, with an eye towards a higher-end product selection. Stores are generally smaller square footage as well, between 3 to 4,000 square feet versus 6 to 10,000 for Cato. Additionally, they have the It's Fashion banner and the It's Fashion Metro banners, the former of which generally operates in smaller markets than the latter. Theoretically, the fashions offered in these stores are a little bit more cutting edge, if you will. We don't know much about cutting edge fashion here on the podcast. That's something we talk very little about, at least with any sort of high-end knowledge or first-hand knowledge. Cato has 1,308 stores in 31 states at the beginning of March. That was as of the beginning of March, though their store count is down about 43 in this past calendar year, closing some underperforming stores, just like in Hibbett. But Cato has taken the same approach as those types of brands, also Goodies and Stage stores, and Ascena, closing several stores in underperforming markets as well, Trent. One other thing we should note here is that Cato, like Costco, releases monthly same-store sales updates. So those sales figures in this quarterly report don't really come as much as a surprise because they keep their investors up to date. Same-store sales did take a big hit in February, down around 10% after flat December sales and January sales being up 2%.
So that brings us to these earnings numbers, and once again, there's a bit of positive and a bit of negative. We'll start with the good news here, which was net earnings. More specifically, the company's net loss was cut drastically. They went from a net loss of $15.5 million for last year's fourth quarter down to just $3.2 million in this year's fourth quarter. Certainly signs of course, boosting those margins up, but also trimming their losses in part because of their store closures and also in part because of other initiatives that the company has undertaken. And while we're never enthralled to see a loss, certainly, a loss cut this substantially, absolutely a good sign, particularly for a retailer that struggled so much in the recent past. On an earnings per share basis, the loss was 13 cents per diluted share this year versus 62 cents last year. The bad news had have to do with same-store sales. We knew overall revenue would likely be down with a reduced store count, and it was, certainly, $190.4 million in this year's quarter versus $211.1 million in last year's quarter. Despite the 10% decline year-over-year, we thought more of it would be driven by store closures and the extra week and the year prior, just like with Hibbett, that extra week coming into play. Instead, good same-store sales numbers for January and December were actually not enough to counteract the poor ones from parts of November and February, so you see more of an impact of those negative comp sales on the top-line revenue. Same-store sales were down on a comparable 52-week basis by 2%, and if you want to find some good news from this, it might come from the relatively small impact on sales from store closures. In fact, when you parse out the numbers, despite closing around 3% of their store base in the past year, those closures only had a slightly greater than 1% negative impact on revenue. This is to say that the stores that closed certainly seem to be the worst performers of the bunch and bringing in a lot less in terms of that revenue than those stores that remained open. The neutral news now for the retailer, it came from margins. And if you wanted to, you could actually look at this as slightly positive news as well. Gross margin was up from 32.9% of sales to 33.1% of sales this year. Positive impacts coming from improved merchandise margins. Negative impacts, however, from higher buying and occupancy costs. And regarding occupancy costs, this was a big note on the earnings call, and we can't say it enough. Retail real estate lease rates, let's face it, folks, they are going up. Don't let any retail CEO who thinks they can leverage retail closures to get lower rates tell you otherwise. Now, merchandise margins did improve, according to CEO John Cato, as a result of refining their inventory control through improved merchandise selection. Inventory control, something that a lot of retailers in these markets, shoot, even retailers like JCPenney, have struggled with. They've struggled to find the solution. And as with Ascena Retail Group, who we'll talk about here in just a little bit, it seems like Cato has started to kind of come around on inventory. However, if you break down the numbers a little bit more deeply, and keep in mind, Cato doesn't have a lot of analyst coverage, so they don't get pressed on this a lot, but if you break down inventory on a value per store basis for inventory, inventories were actually up year over year. In other words, their inventory control seems to be more of a function of store closures than anything else, because on a per store basis, they actually have slightly more inventory by value this year than they did in last year's quarter. Now, selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percentage of sales was lower as well, which is a good sign for the retailer trying to eke out profitability any way they can. One small but interesting tidbit on this earnings call is that revenue from internal financing, late fees, and layaway charges was all up as a percentage of revenue over last year. So this revenue that we're talking about is coming from their private label financing, like their internal credit cards, and their, as we mentioned, the layaway charges, as well as any late fees they might be charging for these things. Over the full year, they pocketed over $500,000 more through these avenues. So this is something that you're really seeing growing for the retailer, and often something that comes with a lot less of a cost than other parts of the business. They do have a private label card, as I mentioned, as well as a number of in-store financing options that have all helped to kind of build out the revenue in this area.
It is interesting when you think about how discretionary income is up, and both lower to maybe, let's say, middle-class households are actually doing better now in the United States, yet a lot of different concepts are making money off of late fees and people not paying on time. It's interesting how that works, but overall, you see that being a positive here for Cato. And looking ahead for Cato, we do have some interesting notes. Unlike many struggling retailers we discuss here on the podcast, Cato is in a position of carrying no debt, zero debt. Guess what that means? No interest expense. And despite losing money fairly regularly, the company is still repurchasing shares, which one could argue they could maybe disperse that capital out for some other activities that could yield a little bit better rate of return. Regardless, they do offer a dividend even still, and they have $210 million in cash and cash equivalents. Again, the question here being is capital allocation. Are the managers working in the shareholders' best interest? One would like to think they are. They are very unique in this overall regard in terms of financing. They also have very little analyst coverage, so it makes one wonder how long they can keep pulling these types of levers to return value to shareholders if they can't climb it to profitability. And I think overall, anybody, any sane person really would have to question the value that the managers right now are giving the company if they don't feel like they can deploy capital in any meaningful way to expand the core competencies of their business. As with Hibbett, Cato expects to see net store closures in their next fiscal year up with around 12 openings against 50 closures. So that balance is not there in the positive realm for the company. They did specify, however, on the call that the closures would dovetail with lease expirations. So they're not actually having to pay those fees, those costly lease settlements up front that we've seen a lot of other retailers do here recently. Unless you're in an all-out bankruptcy scenario, you're going to be tied to those early lease settlements. So that's one thing they are trying to avoid. However, this does create a little bit of concern with us, at least, that some of the stores they'll be closing are actually operating effectively or somewhat effectively, but they're just the most convenient to close, perhaps, right now, given the scenario they're in. This is interesting. Prepared statements did not include any information about digital sales. So definitely hit our radar there. They did mention an expectation of around $13 million of capital expenditure for store development and technological investments. That could mean a number of things, as we now know from having done this podcast for a number of years now. Whenever those blanket statements are brought up, you really have to think exactly where that money is going to and if that is actually going to be a return on capital and significant enough to mention later on down the road. Nowhere else was e-commerce mentioned other than in passing, when Mr. Cato said they were continuing to focus on their merchandise offering, both in-store and online. That brings us to the share price. Cato shares finished trading on Friday at $14.08 per share, near a 52-week low of $13 that they had experienced in March. But we're slightly up towards the end of the week, so I don't know what shareholders saw quite, except that maybe they are at a relative low point versus the last year or so. They didn't pop much one way or another after the call. A lot of people may be disinterested in trying to swing that particular stock. Their dividend is extremely high for a retail company. 33 cents for the most recent quarter comes out to around a 9.4% dividend yield. They may feel pressure to continue to pull the dividend lever because a large percentage of shareholders are institutional, around 81% based on Trent's research. And this ratio has actually increased over the past year. They don't want to alienate those institutional shareholders, certainly. Overall, though, Cato is off a good bit from 52-week highs of around $26.88 per share. Looking ahead, difficult to see a quick bounce back for Cato as a company, especially with limited capital expenditures towards developing and refreshing stores. Instead, their focus seems to be mostly attaining profitability through store closures, and we've seen how that works, and it rarely does for the better part of this company. We see a lot of other retailers like Kmart trying to cut costs, but then not sustaining profitability like they once were. But hard to envision a future where they don't have to eventually dip into their lines of credit. But perhaps we're being a little bit pessimistic here with this retailer. Just not a lot of differentiators between their store and Ascena, Goodies, and others in similar markets. And we honestly think that Goodies has the best differentiator since acquiring the off-price Gordman's chain and leveraging their existing leases to open new off-price stores in many of these same markets. They're really looking at those micro markets and seeing what fits and what doesn't. Whereas here, you're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Well, speaking of Ascena, they drop a not altogether unexpected bombshell Monday as they announce plans to sell their majority stake in Maurice's. As mentioned before, Ascena has struggled particularly with Maurice's stores in smaller to mid-sized markets. Sales have flagged for Maurice's and haven't rebounded as quickly as some of their other brands within their portfolio. Ascena has just a ton of brands underneath their overall larger portfolio. And actually, this has resulted in a trimming of the Maurice's store banner over the last 2 years, including nearly 50 stores in the last calendar year. In the latest quarter, Maurice's comp store sales were positive, but just barely. Now, they rebounded 1% to the good, but after a double-digit fall-off in the same quarter the prior year. Contrast this with a 10% comp increase for both Ann Taylor and Loft, which are seen as high-end retail segment between the two of them, and a 2% increase on top of a double-digit increase in last year's second quarter for Justice, which is Ascena's youth segment. And the funny thing is, during that earnings call, they talked about that 2% increase as though it was disappointing here, even though, again, Ascena has seen much worse times than a 2% increase at Justice. But it becomes very clear overall when you look at everything on the table. The company felt as though they had to make a move out of the value segment, which is the segment they hold both Maurice's and Dress Barn in, and they found a willing buyer. Now, the buyer in this case is Op Capita LLP, a British firm. The transaction is valued at $300 million overall, with $200 million likely to actually go to Ascena, and the rest being assumption of liabilities and other considerations. It's worthwhile to note that the sale is for a majority stake in the company. Now, Ascena will still hold a minority stake going forward, and management called it actually kind of a powerful minority stake, if you will. Some media outlets erroneously reported Ascena's estimated potential boost each year from selling off Maurice's going forward at $300 million, but this isn't actually the case. Again, $300 million for the overall sale, and the reason they might have been confused with that other $300 million figure is that comes actually from some changes Maurice's is making internally, and we'll talk about those here in a second. Now, the benefit from Ascena's standpoint in terms of this sale is that they assume far less of the risk associated with Maurice's going forward, but should still, in theory, benefit from their infrastructure buildouts they've made progress on in the Maurice's division. In fact, a constant thread, if you followed Ascena at all along most of their recent earnings calls, really over the last 2 to 3 years, has been building out IT infrastructure for Maurice's and other stores, kind of bringing things up to date. They felt like a number of things had fallen behind, from technological investments to supply chain investments, and so they've poured a few resources, certainly, over the last couple of years, updating these things. Most importantly, IT infrastructure. They want to leverage things like machine learning going forward to refine their marketing programs and inventory systems. And when I first saw the headline, I was kind of worried because you spend all this time building out your supply chain, building out these IT platforms for Maurice's to use, and then you just sell off the company where you don't actually glean a lot of a benefit from it. But actually, the opposite is true, and I'll talk about that in just a second. One thing I do want to note, though, regarding marketing, and marketing insofar as it pertains to machine learning and the like, it was said in their most recent earnings call that Justice in particular benefited from that refined marketing approach in their new systems for their loyalty program, which management said helped to offset some underperforming areas in Justice in other ways. But the reason I say they stand to benefit going forward from all of this IT infrastructure work is that Ascena will actually support the Maurice's brand going forward, even after the sale, through their IT platform, and they'll actually be reimbursed accordingly for it. In fact, a management services agreement between Op Capita LLP and Ascena will see Ascena lend IT support, supply chain support, and assistance in sourcing and back office work. And this is interesting in particular because supply chain and sourcing were actually two items said to be shortcomings for Ascena in the recent past, including by their own leadership. Their own leadership said that supply chain and sourcing were actually shortcomings. But now you have Acina's leadership being bullish about these two things, but so too apparently is Op Capita to agree to such a deal if they thought that sourcing and supply chain were two of the problems. They certainly would not have agreed to this. So they must be liking something surrounding Maurice's here. And there has been talk that Maurice's inventory control has been better of late. But usually when retailers change hands like this, the new owners feel as though they can enhance operational efficiency, usually in supply chain and sourcing both. Those are the two things that they focus on and say, hey, we can leverage our other strengths to get better in those areas. That's apparently not the case here. They feel like already that Acina's built out Maurice's efficiencies to a point where they like what they see. And one other interesting thing to note, Leighton, Maurice's e-commerce sales were up 24% in their latest quarter, which is a solid number in the apparel segment and certainly speaks to, you know, we talk about IT developments, those are mostly on the back end, but also their e-commerce developments that they've worked on as well.
Yeah, and that's one of the small notes that we made during the last time we covered this company, and that they were funneling a little bit of money into their digital space, and we were wondering how that was going to pay off in terms of those top line sales, given their particular target customer. But it looks like it's really paying off for them. 24% is not a small number by any means. We've been covering retailers that have gotten below double digits in recent quarters. So 24%, certainly a figure that they should be excited about. But more on the sale that is the result of a larger reevaluation by Acina into their business. They're taking a bigger look, this same reevaluation called Change for Growth that produced the enhanced IT systems that Trent just touched on. CEO David Jaffe said that the evaluation process found value in the Maurice's brand and that they were able to parlay that value into a deal that will infuse the company with more cash. They plan to use that cash to strengthen their balance sheet, aka pay off a little bit of that debt that our previous story, that company didn't have much of or any of. Additionally, they noted in the release that their desire to use their services agreement with Op Capita as a template for potentially providing similar services to other retailers in the future is taking hold. This is an interesting impact, really kind of a third level benefit to having overhauled their systems in the last 2 years. The reevaluation, according to the leadership, has been crucial in driving cost savings. In fact, savings of $137 million in fiscal year 2018 came about, and the company estimates it will save another $90 million or so in this fiscal 2019 period. They claim that the movement has saved the company around $300 million to this point and may have identified a further $150 million in, shall we say, synergistic savings beyond 2020. In this case of this sale, the Change for Growth strategy was more of a, and I quote, exploring strategic alternative situation than a cost savings measure, but it wasn't clear that this was going to be the case from the outset. So I would like to think that the company would be happy at the results so far. Hindsight is always 20/20. Looking back, there were clear signs that management had their eyes elsewhere when it came to Maurice's. On the last two earnings calls, Maurice's really was mentioned far less than their other brands, including its value cousin and Dress Barn. The focus was far more on Ann Taylor, Loft, Justice, and others, even when management felt those brands hadn't lived up to expectations in the quarter. When it came to Maurice's, on the last earnings call, Trent, management noted the slight comp sales increase and credited e-commerce. They noted traffic continued to lag at the brand, and then they had moved on. For being such a large slice of the pie at Acina, Maurice's went with very little mention, and this managed to escape the eye of analysts who were really focused on a bit more, and rightly so, on the Change for Growth campaign that they've unveiled.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
The final stage of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look ahead and a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week or month in retail, and we'll turn it over to Leighton.
My looking ahead story comes by the way of Retail Dive, who always has excellent dives into not only the immediate significance of some larger trending stories, but the long-term effects of some of the stories that they've published in the past and how that can affect the common consumer. But for this particular story, they're citing a study in which wearables is actually looking to double in terms of usage, and really on the back of smartwatches in general. They're saying that 15% maybe in terms of the positive growth is expected to come in the next few years. And they're saying that 198 million units could actually be sold this year. And this was actually per an announcement from the International Data Corporation. Yearly growth of about 9% overall for the next 5 to 6 years is slated here. I think this is interesting because this is a story that we've been talking about for a number of companies. One that we actually don't mention on the podcast is Apple, that a lot of other podcasts and a lot of other business news reporters end up talking about in terms of what is exactly the runway here. But for us, I think this really has a lot to do with the companies like Under Armour and the companies that sell these smartwatches to the common consumer. We've often looked at this particular market as one that's stagnated, that really is offering not much more than a stocking stuffer, and that may see a lot of sales in the last 2 to 3 months of each calendar year, but it's not really a sustainable type item, because once you have a smartwatch that's pretty much capable of anything, it can last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and you don't really need to buy another. Same sort of thing with tablets that you've heard from a lot of analysts in the tech space. Just not an item that you're going to buy more than once every few years. However, I think this is interesting because this study does have some legitimacy behind it. One, for a number of reasons, but you really have to look at the consumers that are going to be using those on a daily basis and what their goals are in terms of wearing them. Biometric sensors and virtual assistants, they're really upping their game in terms of the AI that they're supporting. And I think that is something that the average person doesn't really think of. But at a time when a lot of people are concerned about Facebook and even other companies on the social media landscape really entering into their private lives in ways that they didn't foresee, I just still, regardless of this data, don't think that smartwatches or wearables, shall we say, are really going to be taking hold in such a double-digit fashion for the next 5, 6, 7 years. I think pretty much, and again, I'm no analyst with the wearables market, but it's not capped out, but I really think the runway for growth is much smaller than people think. I think the last thing that people want in a wearable is for it to track your every single move now with all of this data that may or may not get sold to a third party. So I think a lot of people are going to be scratching their heads at that, especially if something were to happen, let's say a scandal that comes out of the deeper dive into this particular market. So I'm definitely watching this, and this is something that does impact, like I said, a couple of companies we've talked about recently on the podcast. I mentioned Under Armour, but Under Armour really went all in on tech and pretty much went all out. They had to charge several quarters back from those investments, and I think that they saw what a lot of people still aren't seeing, in that particular space, that wearable space and just technology that surrounds people trying to do better, be better in their lives, it really doesn't take hold. Because if you have the motivation to go to the gym, you don't really need a wearable to get you there. So that is my take, and that is my looking ahead for this week's podcast.
My looking ahead has to do with the produce section. You know, via our friends at Produce Retailer, they had a great article in their last magazine regarding berries. And we're coming up on that time of year. You're already starting to see a lot of California strawberries in particular in the stores, and you've been seeing those now for several weeks depending on where you live in the United States. But this article points out a few interesting developments from berries. Now, first of all, strawberry sales were up 5.9% from the same time in 2017 in the third quarter of 2018 when you compare quarter over quarter. Blueberry sales at some points in 2018 were up 10.5% from the same time in 2017. So you're seeing berry sales go up, increase as people become more health conscious. But one of the interesting things this article points out is trying to find a way to elongate the berry season. This time of year, this spring, is usually the best time to find those berries at an affordable price, because otherwise, if you buy berries out of season, they're oftentimes getting shipped from a lot of different areas. It's very costly, and those berries go bad very quickly. So for a grocery store, it is a risky proposition. And for a produce buyer in particular, it's a risky proposition, because if you take on too many things like raspberries or blackberries, they can go bad very easily, causing a lot of shrink. But at the same time, when done well, berries will add a lot to your top line because they are a little bit more pricey than other fruits and vegetables. So one of the interesting things that the article points out is that there are actually new varieties coming from Mexico and South America for strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and blueberries, including a jumbo blueberry variety from Mexico this season that's just starting to be introduced by some packers, including Sunbelt, which is one of the largest packers of berries in the United States. So my looking ahead really has to do with, first, can stores succeed during this spring berry season? Can they parlay a strong, what should be a strong growing year, into a strong showing in the supermarkets? And then further, we're seeing berries pick up a ton of momentum recently. Can grocery stores get that momentum to continue further into the summer than they have in years past by leveraging those different growing locations? And I speak from a little bit of experience. I actually used to own a small berry farm there, and it is an area where if people find the right berry, they are willing to spend a little bit extra. So can grocery stores win over those customers this spring so that they come back this summer and the fall and next winter for those same delicious jewels of goodness? Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next time. You can check us out on Twitter and Instagram, once again, at Retail Podcast. We'll be back with you soon.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.